You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Good morning and welcome. Welcome to Matinair on Air. Jane Matinair, Greg Buck, Calvinator on the board, coming to you from our studio here at Radio Park in Racine. You can always join us, call or text. The number is the same, 855-752-4842. Leave a comment if you're watching on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and what used to be Twitter. Coming up a little bit later on today, our friend and colleague Todd Alba, the great Todd Alba show from 2 to 4 p.m. They're going to have a No Mo May edition of What's Worse. Today is the 1st of May.
Yeah.
No Mo May is something that's kind of popped up over the last 5 years.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
So join Todd later on today between 2 and 4 for a No Mo May edition of What's Worse. Right now, we are being joined by another colleague and host of Amicus, a law review on Saturdays from 9 to 11 across the network. Jim Santel is here, former U.S. attorney and an acting attorney. Good morning, Jim. How you doing?
Right. A lot of acting going on these days, perhaps more than any of us would like.
Yeah. But
good to be with you, Jane, Greg, Calvin, as always.
Glad to have you with us, Jim. There's a lot going on, and we really wanted to focus on the arrest last week of Judge Hannah Dugan in Milwaukee. This is from ABC News. Wisconsin Supreme Court now temporarily suspends Milwaukee Judge Hannah Dugan after arrest. So if you wouldn't mind breaking this down for us, as to what happened with this suspect and the, I'm particularly curious about this warrant that yes. was presented and the questions around that.
Absolutely. And I think that really is the principal focus. I should say at the outset, as I always have when I've spoken recently about this, just by way of background, I know Hannah Dugan well. She is a professional colleague of mine. I don't know that I've ever actually appeared in her court, but I knew her as a private attorney doing all sorts of wonderful things in the community, continue to be affiliated with her. We're together on various events in the community, one just about 3 weeks ago. And I also consider her a personal friend with a small F. We don't hang out routinely,
sure.
as Greg and I do all the time.
Yeah, totally.
We don't have
right.
that kind of relationship.
Yeah.
But I want to let everyone know that I know her well, and I regard her as an excellent jurist. And so what happens here, of course, we know all the specifics of this. You can actually read the complaint itself. What happens is, of course, that the United States Department of Justice and significantly the United States Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. This is not coming out of, yes, it is coming out of Main Justice, but the core office that is responsible for this prosecution is here in Milwaukee, the Eastern District. It is, again, at 517 East Wisconsin Avenue. It's the federal courthouse. I worked there for about 30 years or so. And so it is important to remember that because this is not just Pam Bondi. This is not just Kash Patel. This is not just the President of the United States of America. This is also prosecutors right here in Milwaukee. Now, right now, there is an interim United States attorney. I served in that role a couple of times, or at least once, once as an interim, once as a presidentially appointed U.S. attorney. And the concept is that during the periods between administrations, one leaves, the next starts, you have to have somebody in charge and control.
Sure.
That does not in any way mean that you somehow lift analysis and lift examination of the U.S. attorney's office for those things that happened during that period. And indeed, you should be focused on that, because what happens here is that prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office go to a federal magistrate judge. They present upon an affidavit, a written document. It's right here in front of me once again. And the affidavit is signed by an FBI agent. It summarizes the results of her investigation to this point. A lot of information gathered from a lot of different people. And the important thing to remember here, just in terms of the legal side of this, is it's all about probable cause. The affidavit is not establishing proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's for a trial down the road. It's not even coming out of, and here's the other very important point, Jane, it's not even coming out of a grand jury yet. Now, what can happen here is that in appropriate circumstances, highlight that, if you've got an exigent circumstance, a need to move quickly, yes, the U.S. attorney does have the authority to issue basically a criminal complaint upon the approval of a federal magistrate judge. It is good for 30 days. And after that 30-day period under the federal rules, it expires basically. And then you have to go to a federal grand jury. That's in our Constitution, right? That's Amendment 5 of the Constitution, John Adams stuff. And so even though that is the basis upon which that criminal complaint, the matter has proceeded to this point, there is also a grand jury in Milwaukee, 23 people. They're polled. They may not be me, but they may be Calvin, maybe Greg, maybe you, that are pulled in, and they have to decide whether or not there is probable cause to indict. She has not been indicted. She's been charged on this criminal complaint, and that's where we are today. An awful lot more thoughts about the need to go so quickly here on a criminal complaint. And as you said, Jane, the real concern that I have about this from being there and in the office is decision to arrest on this criminal complaint. We can dispute whether or not the criminal complaint, whether there's probable cause, there may well be, and a magistrate judge has found that, again, presumed innocent until proven guilty. Important to note, right? But the notion that you arrest someone under these circumstances, here are the standards. We know them well. We've talked about them before. Is the target, is the defendant on a criminal complaint, on an indictment, a risk of flight, or is that person a danger to the community? Those are the two things in the rules, in the statutes that have guided the Department of Justice for years. And here, I look to this and I say, I cannot remember a time in my tenure as an assistant U.S. attorney, as United States attorney, where under these circumstances, where you do not have either one of those with respect to Hannah Dugan, you would make the decision to go ahead and physically arrest her, put her in shackles, that photograph that it plainly we have all seen now, sent out by our director of the FBI. That decision is reserved for what? For truly violent criminals, people who are engaging in gun practices, drugs, gang activity, all sorts of things that really threaten right now the safety and security of our community and who also pose risk of flight. Luigi Mangione, perfect situation. Risk of flight? You bet he was. Yeah. He fled. Risk, danger to the community? Absolutely. He shot someone, again, allegedly, again, proven guilty perhaps one day. He shot someone. And then you look at the other extreme, Donald Trump. 4 indictments, documents, insurrection, paying off a porn star to be quiet, and also violating the rules of a state in the 2020 election. In none of those was Donald Trump arrested. What happens is you call up his attorneys and you say, come on in, we've got these indictments. Let's see if next week, Thursday, you can come in and we'll do this in a diplomatic, a measured way. It's safer. It's more secure. You can make the argument that Donald Trump was both a risk of flight, given what we think may be his financial resources, and also danger to the community. Maybe so, given what he has done in the past. And even there, the Department of Justice made the determination that there is no reason to bring him in under shackles. Eric Adams, indicted again by the Department of Justice. What happens there? Again, a criminal complaint, an indictment alleging fraud. What's the decision? To bring him in again in this very measured way. A date certain, he appears. Yes, you get processed. Yes, you get the mugshot, so to speak.
Right.
But the notion that somehow this particular case prompts the need to arrest someone in these circumstances. And the final thing I'll say about this, I've gone on way too long, but it's important, I think, to understand. If you made that unsupported decision about arrest, which is, I don't want to say unprecedented, we use that word too much, but almost unknown to me, and I think to defense attorneys, to prosecutors, to others out there, if you made that decision on this procedural issue to arrest, and then, of course, she's immediately released. Why? Because she doesn't pose a risk of life. Right. Isn't a danger. If you made that decision, the same people doing that made the decision that this is a predicate for charging her in the first place. And it makes you, and that doesn't make you wonder. We know what's going on here. It's the Department of Justice calling the interim U.S. attorney and saying, we need to make an example of this person.
Yes.
Charge her. And oh, by the way, grab her and bring her in under shackles. That is contrary to so many policies and practices of the Department of Justice. I am horrified and I'm shocked that the agency for which I worked for 30 years has made that decision.
If you're just joining us, Jim Santel is our guest. He's a former U.S. attorney, also has a wonderful show on Saturday mornings from 9 to 11 across the network called Amicus, a law review. And we're talking about the case of Judge Hannah Dugan in Milwaukee, who was arrested last week. A couple of things I want to go back to just briefly, Jim. I think what you said about the grand jury is really important. Grand juries are not made up of people who the attorneys know are going to be on their side, and then they just pick them and pluck them out and put them on a grand jury. That's not how that works. Grand juries are made up of regular Americans, correct?
Absolutely. Pulled in the same way you stock a trial jury. You're summoned in, and there's a process for your selection. They're in place for 18 months, and they decide, once again, whether the government has shown probable cause, not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, probable cause to indict.
And I'm also assuming that if I volunteered to be on a particular grand jury, that might raise some eyebrows, and then I might not get picked for that said jury.
Jane, Greg, Calvin, you can send your letter in to the magistrate who selects and say, gosh, I'd really like to work on this.
I was just going to say,
pick me,
please. Anyway, the woman who's with her hand raised in the front row.
With the wonderful
brooch. The answer is it doesn't work that way. You want to get people, again, who are certainly in the community, who have that capacity to, we call it critical thinking, right? To take a look. You don't have to be a lawyer. You're not a lawyer if you're on the grand jury. Take a look at evidence and apply your common sense as a citizen of the community, again, Eastern Wisconsin, and determine whether or not, again, at this lower standard, you are convinced that the evidence, the witnesses you've heard, the documents you've seen establish that very lowest level of criminal culpability.
So the grand juries who indicted, say, some of the January 6th attackers, these were grand juries who decided after hearing the evidence that these people should go to trial. That's part of what's called due process, right?
Absolutely. Every single one of those 1,000 more people, now pardoned, as we know, but every single one of them, some of them brought in on criminal complaints. But again, within 30 days, the U.S. attorneys around the country went into the grand juries, got that document, and that's the basis upon which this proceeds. Here is the question I think you're heading to, Jane, which is knowing that these folks in the grand jury, they're impaneled for 18 months. We do not watch their private proceedings.
Right.
This is not an open court for all sorts of good reasons. But they also live in the community. I suspect that many, if not all of them, have seen the huge amount of coverage about this. Does one of them ask about the motivation for this? Putting aside the evidence about this, does that question get asked? Does that question get answered? Where is the genesis? Why are we doing this particular case? What justice-related, rule of law-related mission does this accomplish? That question should be asked by them.
We're going to continue our conversation with Jim Santel on the other side. Stay with us. You are listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Good morning and welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Buck. Caliente on the board, coming to you from our studio at Radio Park in Racine. You can join us, call or text. The number is the same, 855-752-4842. Leave a comment if you're watching on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and what used to be Twitter. Our guest, our friend and colleague and host of Amicus, a law review Saturday mornings from 9 to 11 across the network, Jim Santel is here. We're talking about the Judge Hannah Dugan arrest from last week. We're going to get back to that. But breaking news, just as we come back on the air from CBS News, Trump's national security advisor, Mike Walls, and his deputy are out at the White House. Last month, Walls came under scrutiny after putting together that Signal chat. Oopsie, included a reporter from The Atlantic.
Womp womp.
Who then shared the details of the sharing war plans over an unsecured app, which has messages that disappear, so they no longer become, they fall under the FOIA rules.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is the first fallout. And I'd seen a lot of people finger Mike Walls as who was going to be the sacrificial lamb, because somebody's got to go for this. So this at least is the beginning.
And it ain't going to be Pete Hegseth. For now.
Not for now. We'll see what happens. But that's breaking just as we came on the air. Jim, I want to go back to Judge Hannah Dugan and her arrest last week. And I think it's really important that we understand how unusual it was for her to be cuffed and arrested and have that all go down, because that's not normal. And they could have, the Biden administration Justice Department could have done this to Donald Trump, right? They could have cuffed him. They could have cuffed him and done a perp walk, and they didn't do that because he didn't fall under the, you know, the whole flight risk and all danger to the public and all that stuff, which in my estimation, neither does Judge Dugan. She didn't seem to be a flight risk. She wasn't a danger to the community. This was a performative arrest.
Absolutely. And although he didn't use the word perp with respect to her, I'm also very troubled. Language means something, right, Jane?
Yes.
I'm also very troubled by the fact that my director of the FBI referred to the underlying case. Again, it's involving Eduardo Flores Ruiz. We know about that. Referred to him as the perp. And again, you know, obviously it's short for perpetrator. That's the kind of, I would say, guttural language that I would not expect from law enforcement. Let's use their name. Let's identify him as the defendant, those kinds of things. It reflects once again the point that you made so well, Jane, which is, this is for image, this is for performance, and this is to tell the world, not just Wisconsin, not just the United States, but the world, look what we can do.
Yeah.
If you cross us, and if you take a stand, if you do something, may or may not be criminal in nature, again, we'll reserve that for another day, but if you do that, we will put you in chains, and we'll bring you to a federal courthouse and ask you to respond to a magistrate judge who's going to read the charges that we have brought against you. We talk a lot about deterrence, you and I and Greg and Calvin. There is good deterrence and there is bad deterrence, right? There is good deterrence to stop a particular person from acting. And then there's the general community deterrence. You want people to know that if you rob a bank, yes, you will get in trouble, right? That's a good thing, right? Here, what you're doing is you're deterring people from speaking. And again, it's not so much a First Amendment case. You're deterring people from doing the things that they would otherwise do in support of civil rights and human rights. Even a judge, especially in her courtroom, has that capacity. What here you are doing is you're sending the message to a larger community. Don't have to be a circuit court judge. Maybe you are just among the, again, as you said, the normal people who are out there doing your jobs, doing your work, have your family, your business, making your way in life. And if you cross us, this might happen to you. And that's what that picture is all about.
Absolutely. And at least in Judge Dugan's instance, she's got some resources. She has assembled a legal team now. But for the average person, you know, not all of this stuff is being done pro bono. And we've talked about this before as far as the intimidation factor. It's not necessarily that you do something the administration doesn't like and they're going to immediately jail you, but they can ruin your life.
Yes.
By taking you to court and bleeding you dry financially.
As we've often said on this wonderful program, the investigation and here the charging is the punishment. And even if it turns out that the grand jury here, others, other cases involving people who used to be a part of the Trump administration, he's identified two already in that category, referred for investigation. Even if it doesn't result in a criminal prosecution going to trial, the reality is that responding to subpoenas, requests for information, interviews, financial materials, all kinds of things, that costs money.
Yep.
And it costs lawyer resources. And that's why I'm so proud of a portion of my profession, and I'd like to think including me as well, that's come forward and said, you know what, we will do the representation pro bono to ensure that those people inappropriately targeted are not the victims of complete economic devastation.
Well, and now, but we have a whole bunch of law firms who have already capitulated to the Trump administration.
Absolutely.
And what the heck are they going to do when the Trump administration comes to them and says, we want you to go after this guy?
And do it for free.
And you're doing it pro bono.
Mm-hmm. And that's the problem in dealing with Donald Trump, of course, the changing contract, if you will, to put it a whole lot more charitably than it should be, right? We'll put this arrangement together. We will stay away from you for now.
For now.
For now.
Mm-hmm.
But if you run afoul of what we want you to do, then we're coming back and we'll do more of that. It is, again, deterrence of a very bad nature. It is intimidation, which is a better way to think about it.
This
regrettably, again, I asked the question. I think the attorney general should be asked, and the director of the FBI, where did this come from? What's the motivation for doing this, Madam Attorney General?
Join Jim Santel Saturdays from 9 to 11 across the network for Amicus, a law review. Thank you so very much, Jim. Really appreciate your time. By the way, Judge, I still volunteer to be on that grand jury. I'm available. I'll make myself available. News is coming up next. Stay close. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, and Calvin Ader on the board, coming to you from our studio here at Radio Park in Racine. You can always join us. Call or text at 855-752-4842. Leave a comment if you're watching on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and what used to be Twitter. Shout out to Sherry on the text line in Horicon. She's just checking in, saying hello. Hello, Sherry. Thank you so much,
Sherry,
for being with us. And just a heads up, too, we got baseball coming up later on today. Crew at the White Sox games. Our broadcast, rather, starts at 6:05 tonight. You do have to listen to actual terrestrial radio. Mm-hmm. If you want to catch the game, you can listen on WRCE in Richland Center, WISS in Oshkosh, WRJN here in Racine and Kenosha, WCQM in Park Falls near Butternut. And WBZH AM in Hayward, our newest Milwaukee Brewers affiliate. The Crew at the Sox, they beat them last night. Our broadcast starts at 6:05. Right now, we are being joined by Emma Schatz. She is the Digital Communications Coordinator with the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. Good morning, Emma. Thank you so much for joining us. I saw this headline in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Keith Ulig with the byline from the Green Bay Press Gazette. It says, Wisconsin Fat Bird Week celebrates Junco in the Trunco and other chunky feathered friends. I laughed so hard, I almost had coffee coming out of my nose.
I think that's one of our better names for the contestants. It's so good.
It's so funny. So tell us about Fat Bird Week in Wisconsin. I can't believe I have never heard of this before. I know of Fat Bear Week. They do that in Alaska.
Yes.
That's a big thing.
Yep.
They do Fat Bear Week.
It is a big thing.
And so when did Fat Bird Week in Wisconsin get going?
So last year was our first time doing it. So this is only our second year. And we were inspired by Fat Bear Week. Excellent. So we actually reached out to the comms team at Katmai National Park, and we got their blessing, their permission to take our own space. So what better way to do it with birds in Wisconsin?
That is very fitting. That is so funny. Well, tell us, first of all, Emma, what is the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin? What is it that you do?
Yes. Yeah, so we are an environmental nonprofit, and our mission is to protect Wisconsin's lands, waters, and wildlife. And so we provide funding, and we lead partnerships and connect all people with nature. And so our work spans all across the state.
And so what how does Fat Bird Week work? What do we need to do to be involved in Fat Bird Week?
So every day, starting this Friday, May 2nd to May 9th, the public gets to vote daily for their favorite fat bird. And so we have 8 incredible, chunky, very round, very fluffy contestants. And so they compete in different matchups. So it's a single elimination bracket style tournament. And so the first round of voting opens this Friday at 9 a.m. You can just go to our website, wisconservation.org. And the first round of voting will be open for 48 hours. And then the second round opens at 9 a.m. on Sunday. And that will remain open for 24 hours. And then all of the following rounds will open daily at 9 a.m. You'll have 24 hours to vote until the final round on Friday. And then we'll announce the winner on Monday, May 12th.
I'm very excited.
Yes, you are very, very, excited. Very, very excited. Really quick, just for our more, you know, is there a website on DraftKings I can find out odds on who's got what? And, you know, we're a very bracket heavy society now.
Yes.
So I have to imagine there's someone looking at this going, I got 3-1 on the well-fed yellow warbler.
Yeah. So something new we're doing this year is we are encouraging like either workplaces or friend groups or families, if you wanted to do kind of like a March Madness pay-to-play situation, we have a bracket that you can download on our webpage. So it's wisconservation.org/fatbirdweek. And so you can, you know, donate some money to play with your friends or your family and submit your predictions. So
And really, I'm assuming, Emma, that this is just to raise awareness and get people interested and excited about all the nature that we're surrounded with here in Wisconsin.
Exactly. Yeah. So the main point is to celebrate our native bird species, but also learn how to help them. So we are partnering with SOS Save Our Songbirds, which is another bird conservation organization, to share ways that we can help protect these birds, because, you know, there's over in Wisconsin alone, there's over 60 bird species that are listed as either endangered, threatened, or have declining populations. And there are small changes that we can make at home to make a difference. And so we're trying to, you know, bring the community together in a fun and engaging way, but then also have that educational aspect of sharing ways that we can help protect them.
And what are some things that we can do, Emma? What should we be doing in our own backyards?
Yeah, so SOS Save Our Songbirds has 3 main ways to help protect Wisconsin's birds, and that's planting native plants. So whether you have a big garden or just a balcony, there are a bunch of different plant species that you can do. Also preventing window collisions, that's a really big issue. There's, I think, let's see, I know I have a stat. Yeah, this was shocking to me, but up to 3.5 billion birds are killed every year in the U.S. after flying into glass. Oh. And so, you know, whether that's fixing a window in your home that tends to be a problem for birds, or on a larger scale, working like with your office or a larger building to try and prevent those window collisions. There's a lot of ways to reduce those deaths, and resources on sossaveoursongbirds.org. And then the third one is drinking bird-friendly coffee. So not a lot of people are aware that most coffee is grown in ways that destroy migratory songbird habitats. And so there are a couple brands that the SOS recommends you can switch to help protect migratory bird habitat as well.
That came up. Okay, so that's both shocking, and of course I'm not shocked at all. And I went to my my computer and typed in bird, and before I got the word friendly out, coffee was the first thing that populated on Google.
Wow.
There are a bunch of different brands that are, quote, are considered bird-friendly blends.
If you are just joining us, Emma Schatz is our guest, and we're talking about Fat Bird Week, baby. Going on right now, Emma is with the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, and we're just going to go over some of the contestants.
I feel like we should have gotten some like game show music,
right? Yeah, and then if this were the draft, and then they would fly out onto the stage with fireworks and all that stuff. So the contestants for the Fat Bird Week are the round yellow rumped warbler, the well-fed yellow warbler, the rotund, ruby-throated hummingbird, the pudgy pine warbler, the dark-eyed junco in the trunco, which just kills me, the neckless northern cardinal, enormous eastern bluebird, and the spherical white-throated sparrow. You guys must have had so much fun coming up with those, Emma. I wish I had been in on that meeting.
It was a lot of fun, and I have to give credit to my supervisor, Shelley, for coming up with Junco in the Trunco.
So good.
That's just
I want a t-shirt with that, just because it's hilarious.
And the way it's looking at us in the picture, it just looks so mad.
Shizu on the live stream says, are these chunky, or are they, oh, Lord, he's coming big. How big are we talking about?
That's a good question. There's a lot to consider when, you know, choosing who you want to vote for each round, because in the world of fat birds, you know, fat can mean how round are they? Mm-hmm. Is there a neck? But also how fluffy are they? Because for the birds that don't migrate, they're not necessarily gaining fat, but they're fluffing up their feathers in the winter to stay warm.
Sure.
And so we consider that like a classification of fatness. How fluffy are they? Because it makes them look a lot rounder. So there's a lot of things to consider.
Lots of things involved in this. This is not just a fly-by-night exercise.
God. Emma, I just have one question for you. You are, of course, you know, you work for this group, and you've been talking about it. You've been working on the brackets and qualifying the contestants. Who do you have on your bracket? Who do you think is going to be the winner?
I don't know if I want to say. I don't want to influence people's decision.
I think that's fair. I think you should keep it to yourself, Emma.
I think there's some strong contenders, but I'm really interested to see what happens in the earlier rounds, because some of the matchups, I think it'll be harder to decide between the two than others. So, and that could just, you know, change the whole game.
The tension surrounding this, the excitement, the betting, it's just crazy. 855.
I lost my house on the fat bird contest.
855-752-4842. Ollie from the Northwoods is on the line. Good morning, Ollie. Thanks for joining us.
No, this sounds like a wonderful thing to do, this fat bird contest. But I just have a question. Are they concerned about the bird flu and people feeding? Should you feed? Should you not feed? And bird baths and things.
That's a great question, Ollie. Emma, I don't know if you can address that at all. But can we be feeding our birds? Because I've got water in my bird baths now.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure. I don't have a lot of information on that, so I don't want to, you know.
We'll do a different follow up.
Yeah.
We'll do a different follow up on that. But
I'm just gonna say it. I think it's gonna be the dark eyed junco and the trunco up against the rotund ruby throated hummingbird. That's gonna be the final matchup.
And what leads you to that?
Well, first of all, the dark eyed junco and the trunco. The name alone is gonna gather a lot of votes. That's just good marketing, good branding.
It
right
is.
There.
That's true.
And the rotund ruby throated hummingbird just looks like it's ready for victory. I mean, look at that thing. It's just It will not take second place.
Are you seeing a lot of lobbying dollars coming in with this, Emma? You know, the pro junco and the trunco group is, you know,
is
putting
big
a
bird
lot
in
of
this.
Is big bird involved? Yes.
And you know, the name is such a good factor to consider too. And I know a lot of people have been commenting about that spherical white-throated sparrow too. And it's really? All about the angles. Really? Yeah.
I mean,
but, you know, I think the ruby-throated hummingbird is just so impressive because they are such tiny birds, but they actually pack on a lot of fat and like for their migration. They, in one day, they have to have like the human equivalent of 150,000 calories.
Yeah, it's insane.
During migration.
Yeah, it's insane. It's insane how far they fly.
You also have to consider that, like, they are so tiny, but then they eat so much.
Lots involved in this. We're going to put all of the links in our show notes so we can all get involved. Let's make this a thing. I would love to see this turn into a really, really big thing. Emma Schatz has been our guest with the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin talking about Fat Bird Week, baby. Again, check our show notes at civicmedia.us. Emma, thank you so very much. It's been a delight.
So much.
Have a great day. Stay with us. We're going to wrap it up with this Shouldn't Be a Thing Angry Bird Edition.
Mm-hmm.
This is Nat Nair on Air on the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back to Nat Nair on Air. Jane Nat Nair, Greg Bach, Sweet Calby on the board, coming to you from our studio here at Radio Park in Racine, where you can always join us. Call or text. The number is the same, 855-752-4842. Leave a comment if you're watching on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and what used to be Twitter. Coming up on the show tomorrow, last day of April.
No, it's not.
April 30th.
You're all liar pants.
April 30th, tomorrow, the last day of April, Dr. Kristen Lyerly will be here,
yes.
Our friend and colleague, and now she has a show on the weekends, on Saturdays and Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Kristen Lyerly joining us tomorrow after the 9:30 news. David Drake is coming back. You know how I love David. We talk about birds.
You
makes
do.
Me very
sometimes
happy.
I just walk out of the room and it's like I was never here. I come back and it's like, oh, cool. All
She's
right.
Still talking about birds. David Drake will be joining us. We're going to talk actually about the endangered species list.
Okay.
This is not a laughing matter.
Yes.
There are some people now within the Trump administration who think that, yeah, do we need this anymore? If we just destroy all their habitat, does that really constitute harm?
It's not like I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So
David Drake will be joining us in hour number two tomorrow. Yeah. So I hope you can join us for that. Right now, though, it is 11:54 Calvin. That means it's time for
This Shouldn't Be a Thing.
As always, if you have a thing you think should not be, send it in to Greg and me at janesays@civicmedia.us. Calvin found this one. Calvin, I think this is destined to go into the Tisbat Hall of Fame.
Oh, yes.
If there ever is one. This is from The Guardian, Kim Wilshire, that lucky reporter with the byline. Headline reads, historians dispute Bayou Tapestry penis tally after a lengthy debate. Two scholars at loggerheads over whether dangling shapes depict a dagger or the 94th penis on a specific embroidery.
That sentence is great.
In a historical spat that could be subtitled 1066 with knobs on, two medieval experts are engaged in a battle over how many schmeckles are embroidered into the Bayou Tapestry. Oxford professor George Garnett drew worldwide interest 6 years ago when he announced he had counted 93 penises stitched into the embroidered account of the Norman conquest of England, again from 1066.
Mm-hmm.
The 88-year-old professor said they're attached to horses. 88 of them are attached to horses. The remainder are attached to humans. However, another scholar now, Dr. Christopher Monk, says, no, it's not 93 schmeckles on this embroidered piece. It's 94.
Have I ever told you, Jane, how much I love my job?
No, not lately.
I am currently...
Look at what you learned.
I was... Sure. Okay. I was going to say things I get to say on the air. I mean, the idea, it's like they're having a schmeckle fight here.
I just think it's great that this is what researchers, professors are researching.
And it is a foundational, educated discussion they're having too. It's not two guys yelling at each other in a bar.
No.
It's two men in tweed jackets with the elbow pads.
Patches.
Really going back and forth to say, no, sir, 93.
A running man depicted in the border of the tapestry has something dangling beneath his tunic. One professor says it's the scabbard of a sword or a dagger. The other professor says, no, that's a schmeckle. I am in no doubt that the appendage is a depiction of male genitalia. The detail is surprisingly anatomically fulsome.
Could you imagine a guy on like a dating site going, I'm fulsome? Like, yeah, that's just not that. Actually, no, that's a great word to describe yourself.
That is a good word.
Oh.
The Bayeux Museum in Normandy, which is home to the 70 meter long embroidery, says the story it tells is an epic poem and a moralistic work. The historians both insist that beyond all the stupid jokes and sexual innuendo, their work is not silly. This is about understanding medieval minds. The whole point of studying history is to understand how people thought in the past. They were not crude, unsophisticated, or dim-witted. Quite the opposite. What I've shown is that this is a serious, learned attempt to comment on the conquest, albeit in code.
Okay, Professor, stop trying to kill our fun, for one thing. And second of all, I think we could have learned all those things like 90, 91 schmeckles ago. Like, to find another one proves nothing more. Like, we understand that they didn't wear underwear or pants, and they let their freak flags fly all up. Fine. And the horses were excited about war. But I think that finding one more doesn't make it that much more educational. Like, it doesn't like, oh, I didn't know. I did not take you seriously until the 94th Schmeckle Jane.
They want to be accurate.
Yeah.
They're historians. They want to be accurate. Calvin, any comments on this, since you're the one who found this?
Yeah, well, in the next paragraph, it says, in the Bayeux tapestry, size did matter. The historian pointed out that the battle's two leaders ride horses with the two largest penises in the tapestry.
The most fulsome, as it were.
Clip clop.
That wraps up today's episode of...
This shouldn't be a thing.
Before it devolves any further, news is coming up next, followed by Tom Hartman. Sorry, Tom. From 11 to 2, Todd Alba from 2 to 4, Maggie Dawn 4 to 6, and Pete Schwaber wraps it up from 6 to 8 p.m. Thank you, Greg and Calvin, and all of our engineers. Without you, nothing works. And thank you most of all for calling and for texting and for listening. It really does mean the world. I hope you find some joy today and you get the chance to share it. Stay right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll see you tomorrow.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.